Last week, we left Alfred Packer, the Colorado cannibal, in a dark cell in Lake City. He had been captured after 9 years on the run, and the state was ready to watch him swing.
History is messy,
weird, wild, anything but boring.
We're rainy day rabbit holes,
exploring the unhinged side of history, politics, and culture.
Let's fall down the rabbit hole.
Welcome back. If you have not listened to last week's episode, you need to go back and listen to it now. That's going to set up all of the grisly, gruesome crimes of Alfred Packer, the Colorado cannibal. This week, we're all done with the gore, and we are going to get into the exciting trial and everything else. There's so much more drama to come. Believe me, it gets crazy.
So is this like Matlock?
Story is not over. All right. So Judge Melville Gary had just delivered a sentence that became the stuff of Colorado legend. According to a local newspaper, Judge M.B. Gary said, "Stand up, ya voracious man-eating son of a bitch, and receive your sentence." It's literally spelled like that. I'm not just putting on a weird year sentence. "When ya came to Hinsdale County, there were 7 Democrats. But you, ate 5 of them, goddamn ya. I sentence ya to be hanged by the neck until you're dead, as a warning against reducing the Democratic population of this county.
Oh my.
Packer, you Republican cannibal. I would sentence you to hell, but the statutes forbid it."
This is insane. So there was a red-blue divide back then.
I apologize for my accent, but it was literally spelled out to be said like that.
That's hilarious.
Okay, well, the 7 Democrats line is the one everyone quotes. The official transcript shows the judge was actually quite eloquent in his hatred for Packer, so that is just lore. He told him, "You, Alfred Packer, have been found guilty of the crime of murder. You have been a man-eater and a destroyer of your kind. You have lived upon the flesh of your fellow creatures." He then ordered them to be hanged until dead. 3 deads.
Okay, dead. Now you need to insert the music here for Hall & Oates. "He's a man eater." Actually, it was she, but we can change that.
But Alfred Packer wasn't ready to meet his maker. He was about to benefit from one of the most embarrassing legal blunders in American history.
Oh,
here we go.
That's pretty impressive, because I've seen in our work, there's plenty of embarrassing blunders.
So Packer was supposed to be executed on May 19th, 1883. But his lawyers were frantically digging through the law books, and they realized something incredible. See, when Packer committed his crimes in 1874, Colorado was a territory.
Oh, good grief.
But by the time he was caught and tried in 1883, Colorado had officially become a state. During the legislative scramble to rewrite the laws for the new state, the politicians made a massive mistake. They accidentally repealed the territorial murder laws without including a savings clause. So this is a huge deal, Jody. In law, there is a principle called ex post facto. It means you can't be punished for a crime under a law that was passed after you committed the act. Because the old territorial law was gone, the new state law wasn't in effect in 1874, there was technically no law under which Packer could be executed for murder.
Oh, good grief. So does he still have money? Is this how he's getting these great, fantastic lawyers?
I have no
like,
idea.
How does he?
There's no
that's
details.
That's genius,
like that.
Really, yeah. Right? Like everybody else would have missed that or not dug that up. That's crazy. How does he get so lucky? But he doesn't deserve it.
No, he doesn't. But the legal drama didn't stop at statehood. There was another massive fight brewing over jurisdiction. Packer's defense team, led by a man we will talk about more in a minute, W.W. Anderson, realized they had a second get-out-of-jail-free card. You see, the location where the bodies were found, Cannibal Plateau, sat on land that was technically part of the Ute Native American Reservation. At the time, reservations were considered federal territory. Packer's lawyer argued that the Colorado state courts had absolutely no authority to try him. They argued the entire case should be thrown out and moved to a federal court.
Well, why even move it if you can't even charge for murder? Because
We'll get to that.
Okay.
So think about how genius and evil this was. If they moved it to federal court, it would have been delayed for years. The federal government in Washington, D.C. didn't have the stomach or the evidence to prosecute a decades-old case from a territory that didn't even exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
This jurisdictional ambiguity is part of why Packer was able to linger in the Gunnison jail for nearly 4 years between his first and second trials. He became a local celebrity during that time.
Grief.
He'd sit by the jail window smoking a pipe, chatting with people on the sidewalk, and even selling autographs to tourists. He was essentially a 19th century true crime influencer while the lawyers argued over map lines and tribal treaties. The Colorado Supreme Court was humiliated, but their hands were tied. They had to overturn the death sentence. Packer wasn't free, but he was no longer headed for the gallows. The state, desperate for justice, had to pivot. They couldn't hang him for murder, so they charged him with 5 counts of voluntary manslaughter instead. So that's how they're getting around the murder.
Got it.
In 1886, the circus moved to Gunnison for a second trial. This is where the prosecution decided to stop playing games and prove that Packer didn't eat those men out of necessity. Packer took the stand himself. He was a terrible witness. Surprise.
I was going to say, that's always a good point,
yeah.
Man. And then?
Shifty, inconsistent, and clearly a pathological liar.
Did he make up a whole nother story while he was on the stand? Because the others were clearly not cutting it?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. He kept clinging to the story that it was a starvation winter, that there was no game out there for him and the other men to hunt. And that's the reason that they turned to cannibalism. But the prosecution brought in the local mountain men, the hunters, and Native American scouts who had been in those mountains that same year. These witnesses testified that the winter of 1874 wasn't the desolate wasteland Packer described. Game was everywhere. The snow hadn't been deep enough to drive the deer and elk out of the high country. In fact, when the search party originally found the bodies, they found a deer carcass just a short distance from the campsite. So obviously there was other meat to eat.
A deer carcass, canned foods,
He had
flour,
other food to eat.
Yeah, he had plenty of other things to eat.
The jury didn't buy the Starving Survivor Act. They found him guilty on all 5 counts. The judge sentenced him to 40 years, 8 years for each man he ate. It was the longest manslaughter sentence in U.S. history at that time.
Wow.
Packer was sent to the state penitentiary in Cannon City, and for the next 15 years, it looked like he was done. But Alfred Packer wasn't going to rot alone.
He didn't seem like the type.
Nope. After the break, we'll meet the girl reporter who decided that Colorado's most famous cannibal deserved a second chance.
What a nice lady.
Welcome back. Now, just as the world was starting to forget about Alfred Packer, a force of nature walked into Cannon City. Enter Polly Pry. Now, if you haven't heard of her, you need to. Her real name was Leonel Ross Campbell, and she was the first female reporter for the Denver Post. She was a pioneer of what they called stunt reporting. She didn't just write about the news, she manufactured it.
I was going to say.
In 1900, Polly went to the prison to interview the infamous man-eater. Expanding a monster, she instead found a frail, blue-eyed old man who spent his time making intricate doll furniture out of cigar boxes and bits of lace.
Oh, wow.
Polly was a master of yellow journalism. She saw a story that would sell papers. She began a relentless campaign in the Post to free him. She called him the most misunderstood man in the West. She argued that 18 years was enough for a victim of circumstance.
Oh my golly.
She cunningly shifted the narrative from cannibal killer to pathos-filled pensioner. But Polly,
I dislike her.
I mean, I like it that she's a lady reporter in the, you know, late 1800s.
Sounds like she got that way.
Early 1900s, yeah.
Circumstances that were probably underhanded.
But Polly wasn't the only one involved. Her bosses at the Denver Post were Harry Tammen and Fred Bonfils. These guys were characters in their own right. Absolute rogues who used the paper as a weapon. And quick side note, Harry Tammen is a name you need to remember. He's going to be a huge part of a future rabbit hole that we're definitely going to go on regarding the infamous Teapot Dome scandal.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
The guy
was tied together.
Yep. The guy was a magnet for corruption and oil money schemes. Tammen and Bonfils, and again, I could probably be butchering those names. I do apologize.
Sounds like they deserve it, though.
Yeah, exactly. Had hired an attorney named W.W. Anderson to help with Packer's legal appeal. But in early 1901, the Post owners discovered that Anderson was playing both sides. They learned that he had taken a payment from them and another payment from Packer's supporters, effectively getting paid twice for the same work. So Polly had set up for people to donate money to Packer's legal defense. And so the Post owners paid W.W. Anderson, and then he also took a payment.
Wow.
From this
double dipping.
This defense fund, yeah. They called Anderson into the Denver Post office to demand their money back. They called him a thief. They threatened him. And Anderson didn't reach for his checkbook. He reached for a revolver.
Oh, wow.
Bang! He shot Fred Bonfils.
Holy cow!
Bang! He shot Harry Tammen.
And then?
The office exploded into chaos. Blood was everywhere. As the gunmen were pinned down, Anderson leveled the gun to finish off the owners. This is where Polly Pry became a legend. She didn't run. She didn't hide. She jumped in front of Harry Tammen, putting her own body between the barrel of the gun and the bleeding publisher. Anderson growled at her, threatening to shoot her if she didn't move. Polly stood her ground, staring him down and stalling him with sheer iron will until the police could burst into the room.
Wow.
Once the gunman was tackled, Polly didn't faint. She ripped off her own skirt. Well, I'm sure just ripped off pieces of her skirt.
I was going to say, she just got naked?
And used the heavy Victorian fabric to pack the wounds of both of the wounded men, effectively stopping them from bleeding out on the floor.
So she saved their lives.
She did.
Wow. Yeah.
Later, the rumors in Denver were even more wild. People claimed her heavy starched petticoats had actually slowed down the bullets before they hit the men, saving
from all
their
the
lives.
Starch in them.
Whether it was
way to go, Polly,
right?
Way to be so tidy and perfect.
Whether it was the skirts or her courage, Polly Pry had saved the paper. Between the shootout and Polly's constant pro-Packer articles, the government finally folded.
Wow.
On January 1st, 1901, Alfred Packer was granted parole.
So full of disappointments.
Yeah. Now notice it was parole. They didn't overturn his sentence. They didn't give him a pardon.
Let him out, but be monitored.
Right.
He was here now?
1901.
1901. Okay.
So he was now a free man in a world that had moved into the 20th century. For a short time, he actually worked as a guard at the Denver Post, the very paper that bought his freedom.
Wow. Well, at least they employed him as well.
Yeah.
They didn't just set him loose to the...
Polly might have had something to do with that, right?
Yeah. Wait, I picture a romance here. Are they going to have a romance?
No. No, he was an old man at this point. And she... Oh, my goodness. So I'm going to do an episode on Polly Pry at this point. This is how we find rabbit holes, right? Yeah. There's some pictures of her that she posed for that are quite scandalous, actually.
Wow.
She was a sexy little minx. All right. So he eventually...
She's a badass.
She is a badass. Even though...
A liar.
She did this. Yeah, she was still a badass. He eventually moved into a small ranch in Littleton. The neighbors actually liked him. They described him as a quiet, polite old man who loved children. With ketchup. No, I'm kidding.
I was wondering.
That's what my brother likes to say. I love kids, especially delicious with barbecue sauce.
Oh my gosh. I don't think it's funny anymore
after this story. And here's the kicker. He became a vegetarian.
So we think.
Yeah, exactly.
In the basement are some bodies where he was getting his protein.
The man who once ate five men couldn't bear to touch a piece of meat.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. I guess once you've had the long pig, regular beef just doesn't cut it.
Oh, my God.
On April 23rd, 1907, Alfred Packer died. He was buried in the Littleton Cemetery with a government headstone.
Ugh.
But even in death, Alfred couldn't stay in the ground. His original grave marker was stolen, and his current veteran stone lists him as Alfred, although he famously tattooed Alfred on his own arm.
So it's fitting.
Yes. To stop the vandals, the Cemetery Association cemented over his grave in 1973.
Wow.
They believe the body is intact, but Ripley's, believe it or not, claims otherwise.
Oh, no. Where?
The museum reportedly paid $20,000 for a partially mummified, dissected skull they claim belongs to Packer. The story goes that his head was removed shortly after burial, the brain was taken for study, and the skull was cured in arsenic before spending years in a traveling sideshow. Kind of like,
yeah,
like Elmer McCurdy.
Yeah,
remember
yeah.
he was mm-hmm. embalmed with arsenic and then went in on a traveling sideshow. As of 2008, the skull, if it is his, resides in San Antonio, Texas. In 1989, forensics experts James Starrs finally exhumed the bodies at the original crime scene at Deadman Gulch. So
oh, okay.
all of those bodies were just buried right in place.
Where they were at.
Yeah.
Okay.
Using modern technology, he proved the starvation defense was a total lie.
Because they all didn't have any starvation signs.
The marks on the bones weren't from desperate hacking. They were from skilled, calculated butchery. But the most bizarre part of his legacy in... this is crazy. This is sick. In 1968, students at the University of Colorado Boulder were asked to name their new cafeteria. Mm-mm. In a landslide vote of dark Colorado irony, they named it the Alfred G. Packer Memorial Grill.
Oh my gosh. And probably everybody now or... they probably thought, oh, that must be somebody who went to school here or
right
invented something cool. Or
there's pictures of this. There's a picture of Alfred Packer like on a column in it.
Oh, good grief.
And you don't want to know what their slogan is? Have a friend for lunch.
Okay. Is it still there?
I think so.
Oh, my God.
Next time I go to Colorado, I'm going to have to go. Can I go on campus? It. I don't know. To this day, you can go to the university, stand under a bust of Alfred, and order a burger. So we've turned this murderer into a mascot.
So America.
Yep.
We are so crass.
We are.
And hilarious. And crass. Wrong. Wrong, wrong, wrong.
Alfred Packer was a liar, a thief, and a butcher. But thanks to a technicality, a brave reporter, and a dark sense of humor, he's a permanent part of Colorado history.
Yeah, a big...
The end.
The end. That was an amazing story. Mortifying. Yeah, yeah. So many things. So many feelings about it. I
know. Yeah, there's the murder. Terrible. The eating the people.
Even more terrible.
Because you just want to. You didn't need to. That's terrifying. Like people who want to do cannibalism because they like it, not because they have to.
Yeah, it's weird.
And then the like people... and this didn't even really get super deep into it. He had all of these supporters after he went to prison that
kinda believed like a Ted Bundy was, or something.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Ugh. Oh, yeah. There was women giving him that were there were women that would go visit him in prison and propose to him. Ugh. You know, and this Polly Pry, whether she believed him or not, she knew he would make a good story. Yeah, and it yeah. did. Like she was smart about that.
Yeah.
As a
that was a business move.
Yeah, exactly. As unethical.
Yeah, yeah.
As she was with that, it was still brilliant.
Yeah, right? I want to hear your story on Polly Pry. I want to hear how she could do some pretty amazing things, as in especially as a woman in that era.
And she actually did do some good things in her career from and the then, little bit I've
and
read
then how
so far.
How does somebody like that justify doing this type of journalism? And knowing, or did she, how damaging that can be, not just in one story, but like to society.
Yeah. And then also think like the victims had families.
Yeah. And they sounded like they were good guys.
Yeah.
Did we ever figure out whose head was missing and where it went?
Oh, gosh. It might have said in the resources, but now I don't remember.
Yeah.
I read so many things and it kind of all jumbled up. And yeah. then I wrote a really long story and then I had to pare it down a lot because it was like 12 pages.
Yeah.
Before he even got to his trial. And I was like, well, we can't do that. It's going to be a 3-hour
episode. I don't think I knew, and people probably don't know because I didn't know when we first started this, how that gets convoluted in your head when you're reading multiple sources. And yeah, it gets some things can get lost in all that.
Yeah. And the details, you're like, ooh, this is a really interesting detail I want to include, but then it doesn't really fit into us right. narrating it. And so we have to cut some details or we have to pare things down because like we'd be here for 2.5 hours. And in fact,
easily, yeah.
one of the things I did is there's a, I can't remember the name of the podcast now, but there's another podcaster that he did a 2.5 hour story on this. And I listened to the whole thing and I was like, I can't have this be a 2.5 hour story. but all of the podcasts I found out there about it were a minimum of an hour long. Mm-hmm. It's just too much of a story. Like just his cannibalism part of it.
Right. That's
and all the different mm-hmm. lies and the wandering into town and all that. That's a meaty story in itself.
Yes.
And then you get to the trial and all the like
It just continues.
All the mishaps, and then Polly Pry comes in.
I'll bet you in those 9 years in between have a lot of tales to tell, too.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably. I mean, he wasn't just doing nothing. Yeah, this was the Wild West. He was in all the Wild West. He was in Arizona and Montana and Wyoming and Colorado, like the wildest of...
Doing his thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I love these Wild West stories, man.
I know, they're great. It's a time that... It's just a moment in time that hadn't happened before and won't happen again.
Yeah. And it's interesting how, you know, you have certain people that are trying to like, got to get some laws over here.
Right.
And other people are like, my law is my gun, you know.
The only time I see this happening again is if we start to occupy space. And then that'll become the wild space.
Well, that's Elon Musk's dream.
Yeah. I'm hoping I'm not here when that happens.
Yeah, seems. But anyways, well, thank you, everyone. All right. Well, we will see you next week. Thanks for joining me on this little meaty adventure.
Thanks for this meaty story.
Let's go have a sandwich. Yeah. Is the McRib back at McDonald's?
Oh my God.
Bye. You've been listening to Rainy Day Rabbit Holes, if you forgot already. You can find more stories like this, plus photos and sources at rainydayrabbitholes.com. Our site is built by Letha Davis at easybreezy.com. That's E-A-S-Y-B-R-Z-Y.
Easy breezy.
It's breezy. Our social media wizard is Logan Hine at Redemption Industries. And you can join our Patreon for bonus episodes and ad-free listening. The link's right there on our website. Rainy Day Rabbit Holes is a proud member of MSW Media. And this episode was produced and edited by me, Shay.
Master... editor.
I wouldn't go that far, but I'm not bad. Not bad.
Not bad editor.
So thanks for listening. Stay curious and
see you down the rabbit hole.
Hi, I'm Moji Alawodeyo from the Feminist Buzzkills Live Pod, the only podcast that helps you navigate the news in this post-pro anti-abortion hellscape. Each week with co-host Liz Winstead, we dissect all the news from that sketchy intersection of abortion and misogyny with providers and activists working on the ground. The cherry on top is we have amazing comedy guests who help us laugh through the rage. Feminist Buzzkills Live drops Fridays wherever you pod. Listen and subscribe, because when BS is popping, we pop off.